It is my great pleasure to welcome to Many Rivers Books and Tea for the first time as a speaker, our dear friend Ruwa Boll. She is spiritual director of the Journey Center in, I believe it's both Santa Rosa and Petaluma, is that correct?
Private practice, Petaluma. The Journey Center's in Santa Rosa.
Got it.
Yeah, okay. Staff there.
So she has had an eclectic spiritual journey herself and thus actually specializes in speaking to counseling spiritual eclectics and those interested in, or as she puts it, who are being called into the unraveling of the contemplative journey, a nice turn of phrase. So we're delighted to welcome her here to Many Rivers Books and Tea for the first time. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me. What I'd like to do is just start with a couple minutes of silence. And I'm going to ask you to do something that one of my native teachers taught me. When we go in, I'm going to ask you to find the name of the quality that you're bringing or you're intending or praying for into this conversation this evening. The teaching is that whenever we gather like this, it's as if each one of us is a log in a fire, and what we bring or what we want to bring is contributes to creating this flame of love, this flame of the divine that we're all sitting around when we gather like this. So we're going to be quiet for a few moments. I'm just going to ask you to go in and notice if there's something that you bring or that you want to bring. I will say something first, and if you want to say anything, go ahead and speak it. We can even talk together so we get a sense of what's present, and then we'll begin. So I'm just going to ring the bell, and we're going to go into a little bit of quiet. And you go into the place that's sacred for you. Presence.
Gentleness.
Awe.
Transformation.
Openness.
Mystery.
Witnessing.
Desire.
Generosity.
Mother, Father, God, Great Spirit, Holy Spirit, you have so many different names and that which cannot be named. We give thanks for this gathering, for this time together, for all the gifts that are here, known and unknown, spoken and unspoken. And we ask that the blessing, the grace that is here with us be of benefit to us, our friends and family and communities, and everyone and everything on this most precious planet of ours. Amen. thank you for being here this evening. I'm going to just talk a little bit about my own background, just so you have a sense of who I am and where I'm coming from in this process of conversation. And then we have a lot to get through in an hour. That's why I have handouts, because it can be, I'm hoping it's not going to be too much and too overwhelming. We'll get through this, but this way you can go home and reflect, and if you have any questions or another book you want me to put on the book list, please email me. I'd love to be in contact with you around this material. I was born Catherine Elizabeth Mary into a Boston Irish Catholic family. You don't get more Catholic or Irish Catholic than Boston Irish Catholic. My dad taught in a Jesuit university, went to Catholic schools, etc. When I was 12, I left the church. The way I described it is I needed to leave Christianity in order to maintain my relationship with God. I was a spiritual eclectic for 40 years, and primarily focusing on the Native American traditions, although like many eclectics, Buddhism and Jungian psychology, and it was great fun. I was in Berkeley and Cambridge and Santa Cruz, and I remember my dad saying at one point that he had my one of my sisters, who was in Opus Dei, which was a fundamentalist Catholic organization, and I was in a radical feminist witchcraft coven in Santa Cruz. He's going, okay! And he said he had better conversations with me than with my sister, so that was, God bless my daddy. And about 10 years ago, Jesus started showing up in my shamanic journeys, which was extremely upsetting to me, because the only Jesus I knew was the Jesus of my childhood that I had left behind when I was 12. But through grace, through luck, whatever you want to call it, I was exposed to the Christ of the mystics and realized that what I was being invited into was a new relationship with Christianity that was a different face of the Christ. And so some people in this room have witnessed my process of wrestling and struggling and fighting, and you've got to be kidding. But I'm actually now a Roman Catholic again. And as my father said before he died, he's not quite sure that the Pope would think I'm a Roman Catholic, but it's only because I know about faith stages that I think that the Pope is a Roman Catholic. So there you go. So that's me. And no, I was not Kristen Rua. It's a nickname that a Jesuit gave me a long time ago, and it's the Hebrew word ruach that means breath or spirit from Genesis. Gotta love the Jesuits. I wanted to go through some of the material here. We're going to begin on the first page, because this is an important orientation. I'm going to be sharing two maps of the spiritual journey this evening that I personally have found helpful in my work as a spiritual director, sitting with many different people and many different traditions. But the most important thing for me is this first quotation from Alfred Korzybski. I think that's how you pronounce it. Don't mistake the map for the territory. These are just maps, and if you find them useful, great. If they're not interesting, fine. You know, the map of the Rocky Mountains is not the same thing as the Rocky Mountains. So this is just a way of wondering about, reflecting on some of the ways that people describe the spiritual journey. The purpose of the maps are to facilitate understanding, relationship, compassion, communication, respect, and community. So I'm sharing this as a way for us to be reflecting on ourselves and one another. And my hope is that if we can share this kind of understanding when we're sitting with somebody, when we're talking with somebody, when we're listening, we'll have a sense of where this person is coming from and the way that I want to be able to talk to them so we can be in relationship. And also appreciation for difference, to really expand our appreciation for difference. Because, you know, we're all thrown into this community together. And I lived in a radical feminist hippie ghetto for years, and it was great. It's just that I remember working at the Berkeley Free Clinic running the RAP Center, and I knew Reagan was not going to be president because nobody I knew was going to vote for him. And then it was a landslide, and I thought, I think I'm in a ghetto. So So if we don't want to be in a ghetto, it's good to learn about how to respect difference. Another thing that's important is people in all stages and styles can learn from one another. So this isn't about, this is about what we offer to one another. Maps can be misused, and this is crucial. They can be misused to diagnose or pigeonhole another person. I can misuse the map to make myself feel better than or less than. So it's really easy. This stuff is actually tricky. It's always a little tricky when you share it. But I'm going to ask us to just hold us lightly and to remember that this is about making relationship and not about destroying relationship. It's also important here to reflect on how we can talk about stages and not sound as though one is better than the other. And the phrase I always use is, I'm going to be using Christian language a lot tonight because that's my language, but I invite you to translate all of this into your own language, okay? God does not love the eighth grader more than the second grader. And I believe that we are all where we're placed, where we're brought to. So this isn't about one being better than the other, but really understanding the way that the divine, the presence, the holy, the mystery is reflected in each person and each stage. This is another thing that's important. Although the maps describe general stages, please be aware that people express them uniquely. So it's going to depend on the historical period. You can go back and read the mystics from 500 or 600 years ago. When I first started trying to read Teresa of Avila, she was so much like, oh, I'm a woman, and I'm a poor woman, and I'm terrible, and I'm so stupid, and I just like, oh, gag me with a spoon. But that's what it was 500 and 600 years ago. She was a female, and she was being carefully watched by the Inquisition. So all of that, you know, I'm so awful, was part of that culture. Contemporary mystics who were female don't speak in that way anymore. There are many useful maps. These are just two, the ones that I happen to use the most. Ken Wilber, in his book Integral Spirituality, actually has a few pages where he will match all of these maps through all these traditions. He has 5 or 6 Buddhist maps, several Hindu maps, Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross. I don't know that he has any from any indigenous cultures, but there are multiple maps. And so if you're interested and these do or don't resonate, there are lots of other maps you can go take a look at to see if it might better suit. So any questions about that so far? And by the way, if you want to ask questions, just go ahead and interrupt me, okay, please? All right. On the back of this page, there's this thing called Can Liberal Christianity Be Saved? And I wanted to pass this on to you. A friend just forwarded it to me. Because I'm hoping that at the end of tonight, when you look at it, you can see that this is a person looking at stage 4 Christianity and really struggling with a desire that a lot of people have to move into the mystical, that can be misinterpreted as a regression back to conventional. So you probably don't understand that now, but maybe later, after we go through this, when you go back and read the material, you might find it of interest. Hi there, welcome.
I don't know if you've been following. I mean, this basically started with dueling essays.
Oh, I'm sure it has. Yeah.
So you can expand it even further.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. It's been very interesting to watch all this stuff. But the thing that's been helpful for me is you see in some, especially in the Christian tradition, in the Catholic tradition, there are a lot of folks now talking about wanting a reconnection with mystery. And a lot of the Vatican II Catholics are freaking out because it sounds like, oh my God, we want to go back to the priest as God, and the chalice has to be gold, and the priest has to have a fancy dress, and what does this mean? And that's a regression to the conventional 1950s, you know, it's in Latin, so it's mysterious kind of thing. But if you really sit down and talk to a lot of those folks, they're starving for reverence. They're starving for the sacred. Mm-hmm. And that's really, for some people, it might be, let's go back to the good old days when we were Catholic and we knew we were better than everybody else. But for a lot of folks, it's, no, what about mystery? What about beauty? What about not knowing? So it's just been interesting in terms of having this language to listen to where are people coming from. The first thing I want to talk about are the faith styles. And I'm just going to go through this one briefly. We're going to spend most of the time on faith stages. But I thought the faith styles were of interest. And again, I'm just going to talk about this. You can read it more in depth later. John Mabry is down at the Interfaith Seminary in Berkeley. And he was teaching faith stages, and a lot of his students were very uncomfortable with the idea of stages because it sounded hierarchical. And they're Berkeley folks who don't like the idea of hierarchy. So he said, you know, we don't have to do that. Let's look instead at different types of paths, different types of ways of being on a spiritual path that can be in any tradition. And I really like this. He talks about the traditional believer in any path is the person who says, my way is the right way. So you can be a traditional believer. It's on the top one here, this page. So you can be a traditional believer Christian or Jew or Buddhist or Hindu or shaman. You know, my path is the right path. I grew up in traditional Catholicism. Before Vatican II, only Catholics were saved. In fact, my only attempt to do any evangelizing was with our Methodist neighbors when Mrs. Day had to come over and ask my mother to please have me stop telling her sons they were going to hell because they weren't Catholic because they couldn't sleep at night. First and last attempt to convert anybody. I was over that in the third grade. poor Lauren and Kenny, I still remember them. I terrorized them. So that's the traditional believer, less developed, okay? The liberal believer is the person who says, I honor different paths and this is my path. So a traditional believer, Christian or Buddhist or Hindu, I respect that there are other ways to reach the divine, and this is what I'm called to. The spiritual agnostic is the person who is in a particular path, but is always wrestling with it, and is very, very intellectual, always struggling, always wrestling, never knows, changes their mind all the time. And I like how Mabry said that this is a legitimate path. You know, the person who isn't just going to make up their mind about what something means. They're always in this process of what does it mean, what does it mean, disagreeing with themselves, etc. So it's a real intellectual wrestling path. He includes two paths that are new paths, and I'm so grateful he includes them and respects them. The first one is the spiritual eclectic path. And that's the path of the person who is spiritual but not religious. So they're really gathering wisdom from many different traditions and developing their own view and walking that with great integrity. This is a fairly new path, and many of the people in the traditions dismiss this as not a real spiritual path. I remember, you know, I was an eclectic for 40 years, and I remember being down at Mercy Center at a retreat and hearing some people talk about an interfaith conference and who they were going to invite. And I said, well, are you going to invite the spiritual but not religious folks? And the guy got quite upset. In fact, he later apologized to me, and he said, you know, those people just need to make up their mind. You know, you can't do anything if you don't dig a deep well. So I said, so I'm supposed to spin the bottle, and if it lands on Jane, I become a Jane? It's like, how do you make a decision when I couldn't be a Buddhist because I experienced God? I couldn't be Christian because the Christ I knew was like, I'm the only way, and no. And Hinduism, you know, I mean, I didn't find a place where I landed. And so just saying, well, pick something was meaningless to me. So I love the fact that Mabry said that there are people who want to on a spiritual eclectic path, It is a valuable and honorable and deep and true path. And that was important for me to read because a lot of the people I know and work with are eclectics. He also talks about what he calls the secular humanist path, which is the atheist path. It's not the same as the secular path that doesn't believe in anything whose values are about, you know, the size of their car. These are the people whose core spiritual value is service to humanity and the earth. So if you look at, say, for example, a lot of the people who were in Doctors Without Borders, they're not religious, but their entire life is devoted to being in places, serving the poor, and oftentimes putting their life on the line. So that's the secular humanist path. And lastly, there's something called the Jack Believer. The Jack Believer is somebody who is a member of a particular religion or path and believes that they are condemned in terms of that path. So they're somebody who's Hindu, who has stolen money, and who believes that they've accumulated so much negative karma that they're not going to be human next lifetime and they don't even want to bother. Or they've done something and they're going to go to hell, or just whatever the punishment is in a particular tradition. That's the Jack Believer. They're usually people whose sense of religion is the fundamentalist stage, and then they believe that they are condemned in terms of that understanding of their path. Within all of these, so my own journey was, I was brought up traditional believer, became a spiritual eclectic, and then now am a liberal believer. So I stand in Christianity and honor different paths. And it actually was very helpful for me to find that term, because when I realized I was becoming Christian, the only thing I knew about was the traditional, and I knew that didn't fit me. I kind of felt like I was being offered jeans that were several sizes too small. So to actually find the name liberal believer gave me, oh, that's what I am. I'm called to Christ, and I honor people who are on other paths. Within each of these styles, people will move through various stages. So you can have a fundamentalist spiritual eclectic who believes that everybody who's not a spiritual eclectic is an idiot and doesn't know the truth. You can have a fundamentalist Buddhist, which a lot of my Buddhist friends laugh about because they didn't grow up in a Buddhist country, and so they don't know the lady who's offering bananas to the green Buddha so that her baby is a boy. You know, they just know the Dalai Lama, and it's like, well, you know, you guys have fundamentalists too, but, you know, don't know about it because we don't grow up in a Buddhist country. So there are the there is secular humanists. There's a beautiful book that I have on my book list called The Little Book of Atheist Spirituality. And a lot of the current atheists having hissy fits are, we'll get to that when we get to stage four, the people who are angry. And you notice they're like the people who are angry because, you know, the stage three God, that's the guy up there, you know, hating everybody doesn't exist. And we're going, yeah. So they sort of need the stage three God because that's the one they're fighting against. But you can go to that book written by a Frenchman, and this is a guy who's an atheist. He totally respects people on other theistic paths. His experience of the divine or the oneness is in nature, and he actually talks about the spirituality of the atheist path, and it's the only book I've come across that expresses a very mature development of the secular humanist path. And if you're interested, I would encourage you to read it because it's a very moving book. So that, yes,
which
please.
Which book is that?
That's the one called The Little Book of Atheist Spirituality, and there's a book list on the back next to the last one. It's a really lovely book. So that's all I'm going to, you see why I'm giving you handouts, because I'm not expecting you to remember any of this. But so any questions or comments so far? Did that make sense? As you're listening, can you maybe think of people you know in these different faith paths? So you can see why it's helpful to know, because if I'm sitting with a Buddhist in my spiritual direction practice who's a traditional believer, I'm not going to be quoting Rumi. And in fact, oftentimes traditional believers are not going to come to somebody who's not in their spiritual path, because it works best for them to sit with somebody. But I have this one woman who's a Buddhist, and we only use Buddhist language, whereas other people who are in other traditions, you know, you can quote whoever, and it's like, oh, and it all can weave in. So it's just helpful to know who you're talking to. So again, any comments or questions so far? Yes.
So I guess you would say that this whole array of styles or stages would apply to every setting. It's not like you would ever have, let's say, an environment that's spiritually eclectic without it having elements of that fundamentalism, elements of kind of the liberal, true believer, or, you know,
mm-hmm.
all of that.
If sometimes people will come together and they are very much very similar, you know, so that they'll find each other, take stage and path, there'll be a kind of congruence. But if you look at the community as a whole, you'll see a broad range. Yeah, absolutely. Anything else before we move on? So now we're going to go into stages of spiritual development. And again, please remember, this is the tricky one. This is not better or worser, okay? So just, so I'm going to ask you as I'm going through this, and again, this is a lot of material, so I want to leave some time for a conversation. As I'm going through this, just be thinking about who might you know, perhaps, in your life who's like this? And might this information assist you in being in relationship with this person or with this group? The movement from one stage to another often occurs when some life experience invites a person into a new relationship with the divine. So you can literally, if you're sitting with somebody and asking them to tell you their spiritual journey story, you will oftentimes hear them describe life experiences that shifted them or began to shift them. I can remember at 12 the things that were happening that made me look at my childhood religion and go, I don't think so. And then Jesus started showing up in my shamanic journeys, and it was like, oh my God, what the heck is happening here? So, but sometimes it's an external experience, a divorce, an illness, or something happening in a person's meditation process, but something happens where they begin to sense that a kind of unraveling or a shifting might be happening. I love how Ken Wilber uses this thing, that the process is to expand and include. This is not a ladder, but it's a circle. So that with each stage, the stage expands out beyond the previous stage. We all have within us the literal fundamentalist. And there are certain circumstances when mine will be absolutely triggered. And I can be just as rigid and black and white and obnoxious and self-righteous and in the prodigal son, I'm definitely the elder brother. That's part of me, and it's because I've grown beyond it, mostly, I hope, please, but it's still there. So all the previous stages are within us. It's going to be divided into stages 1 through 3 and 4 to 6. Stages 1 through 3 are called first half of life spirituality. And they really have to do with the development of the self, the development of a healthy ego, the development of life. So this is a kind of spirituality that is involved along with the life tasks of the first half of life. Who am I? And how do I fit in? And how do I get to be a part of a community? And what are the choices I'm making in my life? How do I create that healthy ego? The second half of life spirituality, getting initiated in stage 4, is about the gradual unraveling of the false self, and in the Christian language, the emergence of the true self in Christ. And all the traditions will have their different way of languaging that. So first, you build a structure, and then spirit initiates the process of the transformation. Thomas Merton said, be careful of inviting in the Holy Spirit because she will ask you to die. And that really is the dying process of the false self. And that's, and most people in the West are at stage three. So the majority of people spiritually are in first half of life spirituality. And then those, I know several people here in this room have worked with hospice. Sometimes what you actually witness in the dying process, the letting go, the final contemplative release, is you'll see people actually moving through some of the stages as they're on the threshold. So primal undifferentiated, pre-faith, ages 0 to 3, that's really a child learning basic trust. For those of you who know the chakras, that's the first chakra. I'm here, I exist, it's safe, I'm in relationship, I'm welcomed onto this planet. And this is really pre-faith. Although I know people who say they had ecstatic, blissful, unitive experiences when they were quite young children. But in terms of this development theory, they call that pre-faith. And this is, when we go through the stages too, you'll notice it says ages 3 to 7, ages 7 to 12. This is comes from Piaget's stages of cognitive development, because the development of spirituality is very much related to the development of the capacity of the mind. So that's what those ages are. The first stage here is imaginative, and cognitively, ages 3 to 7. And again, the central focus is to experience a sense of safety, being welcomed into the world. And this is the stage of fantasy and story. So stories are crucial. You can see the way that children are brought into their religious tradition by stories. And stories help the child organize the world. In a healthy stage, young stage, the ultimate is loving and dependable. We are chosen and we belong. We are welcomed. So again, using theistic language, the divine is loving. And if the divine isn't loving, there's something that can happen where the divine can be changed into loving. The unhealthy, you know, in children, obviously, you see kids who are really troubled and disturbed. But we're going to be talking about adults. In adults, you see addiction, narcissistic behavior, borderline personality disorder, so people who really carry a core injury in terms of their sense of actually being here and being safe. Magical thinking. Step on a crack, break my mother's back. So that's those folks are usually fairly primitive, and one of the best things that can happen is for them to find themselves in a church or some kind of religious setting that can provide the stage two literal container. That's why things like 12 steps are very, very helpful for folks like this, because it provides a very firm container. This is what you do. This is what you don't do. You're in a group. The group loves you and holds you accountable. So folks like this are desperate for the need of a container. The stage two is, again, ages 7 to 12. That's the literal stage of faith. And this is the fundamentalist stage. This is about the law, Torah. And this is an absolutely necessary stage for people to go through. Just like when you're in a family, you need to know what the rules are. You don't play in the street. You don't say to that lady that's sitting at the thing next to you in the restaurant, you know, you're fat and you shouldn't eat so much. You say please and thank you. Don't touch a hot stove. So this is the place where all of the spiritual traditions teaches people the rules, the law. This is also where things can be taken literally. So again, it's black and white, great deal of clarity. I know what to do. If I say this prayer, I get this outcome. If I do this ritual, this is what's going to happen. So there's a kind of quid pro quo. These are the rules. This is what I do. Everything's going to be fine. I believe this. I do this. I'm going to go to heaven. I believe this. I do this. And I'll have a better life next time. So it's very much black and white. It's very much about the rules. The unhealthy is no tolerance for ambiguity. Again, rigidity, black and white thinking. Enraged intolerance. I know what's right, and there's no space for disagreement. And I'm going to be talking theistically, so I'm going to ask you in your own tradition to be imagining how this might look in your language. In this literal stage, there can be this, well, if I do the right thing will happen, and if it doesn't happen, then there's a great deal of judgment about myself. What's wrong with me? What am I doing wrong? You saw this in the, remember when the New Age started back in the 80s, and it was much more primitive? You know, if you just think the right thought, you create everything, so you'll get what you want. So God forbid you got cancer or something you didn't want, because then it was like, it was just like the Old Testament Job. You did a sinful thing. Well, you know, the New Age has matured, so now people actually know things about co-creation, and that a lot of thinking is about how one responds, and not that, you know, tomorrow I want to be a 112-pound male and I just need to think the right thoughts and that'll happen. But the beginning was primitive. It was literal. And again, there's been a great deal of maturing in the last 30 years. This is the place out of which the website GodHatesFags.com comes. So this is the place of black and white sureness, but it's also the place of enraged intolerance. And so we want to be thoughtful about that, because there are a lot of people in the different traditions who are in this place. So then one of the questions is, how do we interact with somebody who's in this kind of black and white place? Down here at the bottom, I have spiritual abuse at this stage may lead the person to leave spirituality or religion altogether, and oftentimes you do see post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms where the person is frozen and traumatized. Yes, Rob?
What do you mean by spiritual abuse in this stage? What would that look like?
It's not only that the kinds of things you could imagine, where in this kind of a tradition, the people in charge, for example, are absolutely dominant, and you do what they say, and we know that power can corrupt. And so certainly you can see things like sexual abuse, financial abuse, etc. But spiritual, you know, being done by a priest, a rabbi, an imam, whatever, a guru. But it's also the spiritual abuse of being taught that this it can produce the Jack believer, that I am absolutely condemned and I am worthless, and there is nothing I can do and I am helpless. And
so it sounds like a kind of gradation. There's no firm.
That's right.
Here.
That's right. That's right.
You're talking about a spectrum.
That's right. And what happens is, when somebody experiences that, they oftentimes, you know, sometimes they stay in it and become the Jack believer. You know, I believe in this and I'm condemned. But oftentimes they just flee and they just have to get away from anything to do with spirituality. They can't even tolerate it, because what it's associated with is this trauma of this deep experience of being awful, unworthy, etc. So it can be very damaging to people. When I was a therapist many years ago, and my specialty was working with sexual abuse, and probably half of the people that I worked with had to deal with the spiritual components of their abuse, because even if the person who'd abused them was not, a priest or a rabbi or a guru, if the family was religious, somehow the spirituality of the family also got woven into the experience of abuse. So part of the healing from the abuse was also dealing with what this person had learned about religion or spirituality or that spiritual path. Number three, group faith. This is where most people in the West are. And again, the developmental ages or adolescence and early adulthood in terms of cognitive development. The central focus, this is really about community. So this is the person who has a sense of being a part of a stable community where there's agreement on what we all believe in. In the theistic traditions, God tends to be more loving, more forgiving than in the more fundamentalist literal belief where it's more paternal. If you're good, I'll love you. If you're good, this is more, guess what? Sometimes I make mistakes and I'm forgiven. And again, you'll have to translate that into your own traditions. So it's about being a part of a group. And it's about conforming and having the experience of belonging. I remember being at a centering prayer group years ago at a Catholic church down in Santa Cruz that I was teaching centering prayer. And there was a delightful lady in the group, and she said, I just feel sorry for everybody who's not Catholic. And it was so sweet, and it was so dear, and it was so genuine. And that's stage three. She wasn't trying to convert anybody. She wasn't knocking anybody upside the head with the Baltimore Catechism or the Bible. But it was just like, this is it. We know the truth. You know, I just wish other people could know Jesus or Buddha or whatever it is. So that's stage three. The healthy, the ultimate is loving, offers unconditional love to those who belong. Your identity is based on being aligned with a particular community and its beliefs and values. So that gives a sense of meaning and order and direction. Forgiveness is available and perfection more accepted. And faith is a part of one's world and largely unquestioned. There are people in Christian communities in Sonoma County who don't know anybody who's not Christian. As one of my friends said to me, even my junk mail is Christian. And back in my more ghettoized radical feminist days, all of my junk mail was radical feminist. So we can do this in our own ways. But it's just like, you know, I'm part of this group. I know Ronald Reagan isn't going to become president because nobody I know at the Berkeley Free Clinic is going to vote for him. Faith is a part of one's world. We become more aware. And this is where we become more aware of community responsibilities. And not only within our own community, although it tends to be focused there. So service starts coming in. Literal can be a lot about, yeah, maybe we serve each other, but literal can be more about my personal salvation, my personal enlightenment. I'm going to be enlightened this lifetime. This one is more bodhisattva, service, bigger and bigger and bigger sense of community. There's a confidence in the authority of leaders and dependability on the group. So there's a sense of clarity and consistency. So you can see that it's the next phase beyond the literal. So you've got the Torah, you've got the rules, you've got the ground rules. Now it gets a little bit bigger, a little bit more heart-centered, a little bit more loving, but it's still about we've got this correct thing. The unhealthy is that the dependence on the group may discourage personal responsibility and critical thought, self-reflection. Those not in the group can be rejected as other, as non-believers, and can lead to blind defense of one's group. So under stress, there can be that sort of fundamentalist energy pushback. So these are the stages that are all about building one sense. You got the Torah, you got the rules, I know what's right, the commandments, the Eightfold Path, you know, all the ways you're supposed to live. And now I have my community, and I fit in, and all is right with the world. Well, then the fourth stage comes. And the fourth stage is about questioning. It's about doubt. The fourth stage is the place of healthy adolescence. What do you mean women can't be priests? You can't have a vagina on the altar? God can't be, you know, it's like, what? Homosexuality is bad, but I know a lot of gay people and they're wonderful. only Christians are saved, but the rabbi two doors down is the holiest person I've ever met. So those kinds of things start to come forward. And this is very healthy, because what's happening is the person is beginning to reflect on received wisdom. And like the adolescent, looking at everything and saying, do I believe this because my family and community has told me? Or do I believe this because I'm now making it my own? So things are up for grabs. And so people might review everything they've been taught and say, yes, this is right. I really believe in reincarnation, but not because my family told me, but because I've sat with it, I've explored it, I've gone into it, I've allowed myself to question it, and yeah, this is really my truth. So sometimes the person accepts, but now from a more mature place. It's mine and not just received wisdom. Other times people will sort through, this I believe, nah, this I really don't believe. This is a challenging place for everybody, because the stage three community will start experiencing this person as losing their faith or leaving the community. And so oftentimes there's a great deal of effort to try to bring the person back into the fold. And a lot of people come into spiritual direction at this time, because they're starting to think unfamiliar thoughts, and people in their faith community are anxious. What's happening? I'm praying for you. I did a shamanic journey for you. Jesus is in your north, the north of your medicine wheel. Oh my God, what's happening to you? And so you need somebody, I'm speaking from personal experience, but you need to say, it's white buffalo, it's Jesus, you know, get him out of there. And it's like, he's there. So there's a need sometimes to talk to somebody who can just say, this is not a mistake. This is not a failure. This is not a loss. This is actually a part of the journey. And it's been initiated by, in my language, the Holy Spirit. You put it in your language. So this is really an invitation to grow and to become real. And this can be a time of great, again, questioning, seeking, everything's up in the air. You see in the Christian tradition, people like Bishop Shelby Spong. Hi there. It can be very rationalistic, you know, getting rid of the miracles, etc. Jesus is a great moral teacher. So you'll see people in this stage tossing out some of the stuff that feels like magic. There's something I put in here that's personal that I don't see in the literature that I read. Sometimes stage four is primarily rational. The virgin birth. Really? Come on. In the ancient world, women were always having babies by gods, and this was just a way to say it was a sacred story. And the big deal is that it wasn't a rape or a seduction, as it was in many of the Greek stories and Roman stories. But there's another phase that I've watched, which isn't just the rationalist, but this is oftentimes a place where maybe through therapy or through dreams or through experiences, the psychic starts to open. So the other dimensions, the other realms start to open, and people start realizing that the world is bigger than the material world that our culture knows about. So there can be a rationalist aspect, questioning, and then also a psychic aspect. Luckily, I was a spiritual eclectic when these things started happening to me, so people didn't think I was nuts. But I know if I spoke to my family, they were as disturbed by these experiences. I was having, you know, vision of Grandfather Bear, and that was freaking them out as much as my saying, why can't girls be altar boys? It was like, I remember when I wanted to be an altar boy, my mother made my father sit down and tell me why I couldn't be an altar boy. My first experience of that. They now have altar girls. So healthy, you're taking more personal responsibility for your beliefs. There's a demythologizing, a questioning of everything, scrutinizing formerly held beliefs, and the understanding is increasingly held by personal experience. Unhealthy, lost, afraid to stay with the doubt, so kind of going back. you know, I don't, this is too scary, or my friends are saying, you know, you're going to hell, so you try to, and yet it's very tense because you can feel something wanting to grow, and yet everybody around you is, if you go pursue this, you're not going to be a part of our community anymore, and it can be a great loss for folks. There can also be an angry separation and depression around feelings of loneliness and rejection, rationalism. One of the big things that can happen here, and remember I mentioned earlier about the angry atheists, stage four unhealthy can feel a lot like fundamentalism. Because what's happening, you know, like the adolescent has to be mad at mom and dad sometimes to create a space in which they can figure out who they are, some people in stage four have to be against their previous faith community in order to create space. So oftentimes for folks who are in stage four, part of the process in stage four is to help them get to the place where they can be at peace with their previous faith journey or community, but be where they are now. So I have a good friend who's Buddhist, who was brought up Presbyterian, and she's very much like, you know, Rue, I really like you because you're not an asshole, but you're a Christian. It's kind of like, okay, I guess that's my function in her life. But she went to a funeral and she said, I was able to sit there and I could see that these Presbyterians were really getting something out of that funeral. And it's like, yeah, okay, good. Something is starting to soften. So now her Buddhism doesn't have to be against Presbyterianism, it can be for Buddhism. And that's one of the things you're looking for in stage four. And in this particular path, Buddhism, by the way, can be a lifesaver for a lot of people who are trying to find a way to stay spiritual and just cannot deal with the theistic stuff. And some people will stay Buddhist, other people won't. But I send a lot of my stage four people into Buddhist texts. Stage five, mystical faith, beginning of the mystical. This is where you really see the birth of the symbolic imagination. You start finding a greater connection to interfaith dialogue, a re-sacralization of the world. So, yes, you can talk about the virgin birth, and it may or may not be literal, true, in a factual way. You don't even care about that anymore. What it is a deep teaching about our original nature. So what happens is you begin to move into the mystical dimension of a particular tradition. And what's interesting is Ken Wilber said that the great religions are the ones that can nourish people and replenish people at stage three and stage five. And stage three and five conversations are really interesting because you can have a stage three and a stage five Buddhist talking about reincarnation, and you have to ask them what they're actually talking about because it might not be the same thing. You can have a stage three and a stage five Christian talking about resurrection. You can throw the stage four person in there too, and you have to ask them. So that's one of the things I hope, whenever somebody is talking about something, what do you mean by that? Because you might be using the same words. Remember, was it Winston Churchill said that the English and the Americans are two great peoples separated by a common language? Well, as you learn about stages, that's another thing. What do you mean by reincarnation? What do you mean by the untouchables? What do you mean by crucifixion, etc.? Healthy is God within us as well around us. The wisdom literature, oftentimes this is the person who begins to be the prophet. The ego is still here. This is the person who, especially in the initial phases, is halfway up the mountain. So there can be a real challenge around the guru trip. You know, the Hindus do a great job of talking about you're at this place and the cities start happening, the gifts. You know, you can levitate and sacred ash and heal and all this great stuff. But it's dangerous because you can think you've made it and you can start focusing on the gifts instead of God. Same thing in the Christian tradition. Teresa of Avila, you know, her nuns would come and say, oh, I just had an ecstatic experience. I saw the vision of God. And she'd say, great, now go peel the potatoes. So those are wonderful, and the focus is on the divine. So the mystical, when these things start opening up, they're wonderful, but there's enough of an ego, and we all know that the spiritual ego can use anything, including how humble I am, to build itself up. finding new responsibility to challenge and improve the church's institutions, beginning to see other people of other faiths as sisters and brothers, sense of justice extends beyond the definition of one's own group, and interfaith dialogue really becomes possible. Stage five person is the one who can appreciate the similarities without trying to smush everything together. The religions. Stage two and three out here, very far from each other. As people walk this path, they get down here. And so the mystics in the different traditions oftentimes have more in common with one another than they do with the stage two people in their own tradition. They're not the same. This isn't one finger. They're different fingers. But they all know that what the mystic is doing is using the language of my tradition to point to the unnameable. And so that's where the mystics can come together and engage in a level of dialogue. Stage six, sacrificial love, Christ on the cross, the bodhisattva. Beyond individual self, Beatrice Boutroux said, how big is your we? That's the question. I think it was Aurobindo who said we go from somebody to nobody to everybody. Paul said, now it's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. So this is very rare, and my belief is that if it doesn't happen on this side of the veil, it happens on the other side. Okay. Wow. 4 minutes left. I can't believe it. Do you feel like you've all just like eaten five plates of fudge? So this is a lot of material. You can see why I wanted you to have handouts. But can you see why this is helpful to just be able, when you're talking with somebody, who is this person and where are they coming from and how do I listen to them? And I'm using the same words they are, but do we mean the same? I'm hoping that it increases our curiosity and our wonder about all of the many different ways that mystery shows up. And that's what it's, I've been sitting with people for 30 years, and I cannot believe all the different ways how uniquely the divine reveals itself. And so these are some of the lenses through which I listen. So, questions, comments?
That was very helpful.
What was that?
Very helpful to understanding. By mapping it, it helps to visualize what you're talking about. Okay. I really appreciate that you went to all that trouble to tell us about it.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you. I'm glad it's helpful. Did you have your hand up, dear?
This is just a question that I want to hear asked. How do you keep religion from becoming an idol? How do you keep anything from becoming an idol?
Religion is an idol in stages two and three. What helps it move, in my experience, are the spiritual practices that help to open us to greater and greater surrender to that which is greater and that which is mystery. But in two and three, the religion is actually an idol. So the question then for all of us is, how do we assist ourselves and our communities in holding it in such a way that it opens rather than close? So the only thing I know about is spiritual practice and how we are with one another. I think love is one of the things that transforms. I remember sitting with this woman one time who was a fundamentalist who came into the Journey Center, and I completely terrified her because we were sitting in a group talking about her spiritual path, and I'm talking about mystery, and her pupils are getting bigger and bigger, and she'd been brought into a Pentecostal church when she was a kid, and everybody starts falling on the ground and talking this weird language and flailing and knocking over chairs, and she's standing there completely unprepared and terrified out of her mind. And so she found a fundamental church extremely helpful for her. Tight, tight, tight container, black and white. This is who I am. So we're in this group, and she's talking about that, and I said to her, well, maybe God has you exactly in the place where you need to be. Because she's saying, everybody's telling me I need a bigger box. And I said, well, you know, well, the God that I understand is throughout all space and time and is fully in a small box also. And she said, how can you, the weirdo mystery person, be telling me that it's okay to have a small box? It's because of this. Because that's what she needed in order to feel stable and safe with the divine. So you could say that her religion was an idol, but you know what? It was actually keeping her stable and safe and grounded and learning about love to the extent that she was able to express it and experience it in her life. So thank you for that question. Any questions?
It's a little like the second grade and the eighth grade.
That's
just
right.
Because she's in the second grade, then that's where she should be at that point.
And it was so freeing. That was a gift to me, because I haven't been around fundamentalists, and it was like she's talking, and it's like, well, of course, that's what she needs. And within that, she was a very loving person, and she came up to me one time and gave me a big hug, and she said, "You used to really scare me, but I think you're okay." So who knows what was happening? I don't know what was happening. Anything else? Any questions? Any comments from your own tradition, your own experience? Yeah.
It strikes me kind of just the importance or value of diversity.
Can you speak up?
Oh, I was saying it strikes me just the importance or value of diversity, of being around people in different stages. I mean, just, you know, like mm-hmm. you were saying, kind mm-hmm. of encountering someone from who's in the fundamentalist stage and yet be able to see that compassion. Because I imagine kind of being around only other people who are on the same stage naturally would foster kind of rigidity of thinking and of heart as well.
I imagine, I don't know that I've ever met anybody in stage six, but I imagine that somebody in those higher reaches of stage five, stage six, would look at her with, you know, there's so many stories in the Christian scriptures of he looked at this person and loved them. And I think that that's what the holy person does. I don't think they say that they love the highly evolved person. And in fact, the only people that Jesus was ticked off at were the Pharisees, who were so busy telling everybody that they weren't okay. And I like to think he loved them also. He just knew that they needed a good knock upside the head. So my best self could look at that woman and love her. And I'm grateful that for that moment, that capacity was there. And I hope it gets bigger in my life. Yeah.
I've got some friends down in San Francisco who are part of the whole kind of emerging church thing, which is very much Christianity breaking out of stage three into stage four.
Yeah.
And they have this wonderful practice they've been doing lately where they'll pick a topic and they'll have like half a dozen people write like a 2-page essay on sexuality or identity or navigating, you know, shifts in your religious perspective. And it's a wonderful practice. Just, I've gone to about 3 sessions just to hear different people, you know, at different stages, coming from very different places, but having this space that's very accepting of all of them. And they don't really use an explicit developmental model, though I know they're aware of like Ken Wilber and James Fowler.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what's amazing about the practice is just the acceptance.
And that's a great example, and we'll end in just a moment here, of a really healthy stage three community that then welcomes doubt, welcomes questions. Because mm-hmm. that's what happens. You know, if you really have a community that, it's like a healthy family, where everybody really belongs, and you know you were part of this family. And then somebody starts asking questions, and instead of, you're no longer a part of our family, it's like, ask the questions. We all grow and learn from it. So that's when you can see a healthy faith community in any tradition. I have a girlfriend who's Buddhist, and she can go into her community and say, I don't really know if I believe in reincarnation. And nobody throws her out. It's like, okay. Or the joke about the three Jewish women standing outside the synagogue arguing about whether or not God exists, and then the bell rings and they all go into synagogue. It's like, you know, that's the joy of the healthy three, is the person is secure enough that then they're free to start asking and welcome. And again, remember, I'm going to end with this. The stages move through all of the styles. So I want to talk about the traditional believer, because it's easy to think of the traditional believer as stage three and that's it. My dad was a traditional believer Catholic, knew that the Catholic faith was exactly right. And he was reading a book on Francis of Assisi, and Francis said at one point, so precious is a person's faith in God, so precious, we must never interfere with that, for he, meaning God, created all the religions. This was 600 years ago. And my traditional believer father, who loves Francis of Assisi, is like, what? And when he, because of his job, he ended up being able to bring in people of different traditions. He worked at a Jesuit university, different faith styles, etc. And by the time he died, he might have still believed that Catholicism was the truest and fullest expression of the truth, but he had friends in lots of other religions, and he could not only acknowledge the truth in other religions, but even incorporate it. In fact, he had a Jewish prayer said at his funeral. So you can see somebody standing in a tradition and also more and more opening to the light that is reflected in the other traditions. So just, again, it's kind of like three-dimensional chess in Star Trek. You can start playing with it. Who is this person? Remember that? Oh, it is kind of like that. But, you know, you just like lean back into the mystical place and it all makes sense. So can we end now? Is there something that has to be said? Are we done? All right. So we give thanks for diversity. This is the. Just think of all the many different kinds of insects and flowers. That's like us. Oh. Not just bougainvilleas, right? 38. That's not bad for me.
Thanks very much.